playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Heartbreaking scenes from Greece this week, with over 80 people confirmed dead, engulfed by flames from the wildfires which raced across three coastal towns close to Athens. One of the worst hit areas was Mati, and as rescue workers continue to search on land and sea for those missing, there are claims from the Greek government that the fires were started deliberately. 9 days ago, Brian O'Callaghan Westrop from County Clare married Zoe Holohan. 2 days later, they flew to Mati on honeymoon. Brian is now dead and Zoe is recovering in hospital with burns to her head and her hands. Father Shea Casey is a friend of the O'Callaghan Westrop family. When he spoke with Rachel English, he revealed that Brian's death was not the only tragedy to hit the family. Brian's younger brother Colin was killed in a motorbike accident in 1997.
That's just shocking to hear, that this isn't the first time the family has been hit by tragedy.
No, it isn't indeed. And Colin was only 21, 22 when he died. It's only the two boys in the family and Rosemary. They lived in Killaloo, Tinrana in Killaloo. Rosemary has had a little. Rosemary is the mum. She's well used to tragedy and well used to her husband died when the boys were quite young. She brought them up very well. They're lovely lads.
It's impossible to imagine what Brian's mother is going through. I mean, just a week ago, her son was getting married.
That's indeed true. And I talked to her yesterday and they hadn't just found the body at that time. But then later on, she rang me back to tell me that they had found his body. And she was, yesterday evening, she was heading to Athens to identify the body, and she was hoping to bring him back to be buried in Killaloo, you know.
What an awful trip to have to make.
Yeah, and then there's his young wife. Can you imagine her waking up out there to this reality, you know?
Mm. Tell us a little about Brian, because from what we've heard about him so far, he was an incredibly good-natured, helpful person. He was involved in charity work.
He would have been. Like, all the family, they were terribly outgoing, you know, and full of life, you know, really enthusiastic for life, and just took it by the scruff of the neck, like, you know. Done everything with a full heart, like, you know, just saw the needs of other people around about them and that, you know. If he saw somebody in need, he wouldn't be slow to help them, like, you know. Yeah, just a very generous soul, you know. But both that's how they were reared. That's how Rosemary would have wanted to be, you know. About 6 months ago, he called in to me. He was involved in the catering trade. You know, very successful at it, and I had just, you know, full of enthusiasm and zest for life. You know, the photograph you see from there at the wedding is typical of him, you know. Like, life was always just opening up for him, you know. He'd be in his mid-40s now, and there were two incredible young lads, and Rosemary's extraordinarily proud of them, you know.
I'm sure many people's thoughts will be with their mother this morning.
Oh, it's heartbreaking, you know. Now, she's a very strong woman, like, you know. This isn't the first time that Rosemary, if you like, has stood at the foot of the cross, you know. Even yesterday, you know, she's incredibly strong. And kind of a stoic kind of view on things. She'll see that the funeral is done right, and that's how she lives, you know.
Father Shea Casey heard on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Well, Laura Fletcher has been in Mati in Greece all this week reporting for RTE. She met up with the family who were clearing out what's left of their badly damaged holiday home in Mati. George and Georgia and their two children told her they felt lucky to be alive.
The flames were nearby the car. I just exactly got out of the car and I ran down from the block of flats. I found out my wife nearby the sea.
I was desperate. I had nowhere to go. There are cliffs. There is no coast, let's say.
The coast was, if you want to get down to the coast, there were stairs, but the stairs were impossible to get out, to get through them, because the pine trees were
always
exactly covering
in flame.
Them.
And so? my husband just threw me in a way, catching me simultaneously from a very steep cliff. And we found refugee under a cliff.
From the flames.
From the flames and from the smoke.
Of course.
We couldn't breathe. And that's how we got saved. My husband also rescued an invalid woman who couldn't walk. he did the same thing again, and then he rescued also a woman who had very severe injuries. But after 3 or 4 hours, we were waiting for the coast police to come, but they were too slow, and unfortunately that woman passed away in my hands.
The tragic thing is that this girl is a friend of mine since my young years, and unfortunately we did the best we could, you know, to some water and everything to help her.
But the help came too late.
It was too late. It was impossible for all the firemen to go everywhere at the same time. There were too many people asking for help. Night, impossible to find them under the caves or in the sea. Really, really difficult circumstances. And I think that these guys did the best under these circumstances, the best they could. But still, it was too little to face the whole situation.
I can tell you my experience. When I found refugee under the cave, I could hear mothers with their children screaming, but after half an hour, I didn't hear them anymore. Yes. Yes, I think there are so many people who are drowned.
Laura Fletcher reporting from Greece and heard on yesterday's Morning Ireland. The Archbishop of Dublin, Dr. Diarmaid Martin, was Marian Fanucan's guest last Saturday. He told her that there is huge interest in Pope Francis's 36-hour visit to Ireland next month, with the public events in Phoenix Park and Knock completely booked out. And he mapped out the theme of the visit.
There's a candle in the Procathedral which has been lighting for many years to remember victims of abuse. He would be praying beside that candle. He obviously will have to address the question of that part of our history. It's important, I believe, that he doesn't address it as part of our history, but as part of our present, because the wounds are there and new wounds are emerging. If I had been asked 2 years ago about abuse, I would have been talking about institutions and abuse by clergy. But now, you know, there's the Magdalen Laundries, the mother and baby homes, and a whole series of other places where abuse is emerging.
And the Archbishop's recent spat with Minister Josepha Madigan also came up for discussion.
You have a reputation for being a considered kind of a person, and certainly on the question of dealing with child sex abuse, I think you gained an awful lot of respect from an awful lot of people in the country. You seemed to lose the plot. Actually, in the Irish Times today, you get the award for a rush of blood to the head.
The only priest to get an award from Miriam Lord.
And this was Josepha Madigan. Leading prayers in a church where accidentally a priest hasn't shown up.
That wasn't what I was talking about. I say to people, what do you say? I say, blessed be the silly season. What happened was a priest didn't turn up. It was a mistake. And that was it. End of story.
Yeah.
I didn't start talking about it in public. It got on to the front page of a major national newspaper, to a major programme of RTE. By me, from Josepha Madigan.
Well, now, I don't think she ever said that she said Mass.
No, she didn't. Basically what happened was, an event which was just a small mistake became blown up. Arguments were being dragged in. First of all, I never said, and I went out to the parish the week afterwards and repeated, that I never said that what she had done was wrong. I never said it was
I would have thought it was completely appropriate.
I never said it was wrong, particularly wrong, because she was a woman. It then was brought into arguments about this was all due to the fact that there weren't enough priests. And I made a statement saying that there's no shortage of priests in Dublin for Sunday Mass. The shortage of priests are for those priests who 7 days a week are overworked, are doing 6 funerals, baptisms, counselling and so on. The Sunday Mass is not the challenge.
There's a shortage of priests.
There is a shortage of priests, but not for Sunday Mass.
Yeah.
In fact, we probably have too many Masses. But I never said that you shouldn't have done. I never said it. Now, it's amazing, you know, reaction.
But as started talking about a shortage of priests. The dogs in the street.
There's a shortage of priests. But if we think the shortage of priests is about Masses on Sundays, then you're making the priest into a Mass machine.
Archbishop Diarmaid Martin with Marian Fanucan. Well, the concert in Crow Park to honour Pope Francis caused a right royal row over on Liveline. Joe was contacted by parishioners of Father Ray Kelly when it emerged that Nathan Carter had been booked to sing the REM song Everybody Hurts, which Father Ray had made his own on Britain's Got Talent with millions of hits on YouTube. Well, the parishioners of Oldcastle said it was a disgrace that Father Ray hadn't been invited to sing for the Pope. However, Michael from Westport disagreed.
All I wanted to say, Joe, is that I'm rather appalled at the shameless self-promotion of this priest. He's an important job to do, and I would ask him to stick to it and do it. Most priests of my acquaintance have a certain modesty. He is apparently miffed that he's not singing for the Pope. Well, all I can say is he has his job to do.
Well, in fairness, it was his parishioners who contacted us initially.
It may well be, but yeah. He seems to be enthusiastically going along with it. We've been down this road. We've had our holy shows and our singing priests and our dancing priests. And I won't go into some of the detail, but we know where a lot of that has led. Stick to his job.
OK, and how do you hear that, Father Ray?
Can I just say that, you know, I do my job very, very well. And if you ask anybody here in my parish of Oldcastle, I do that very, very well. And through no fault of my own, through the Hallelujah story 4.5 years ago, I was brought out of the limelight, basically, to sing. And it has brought a lot of joy and happiness to people's lives. And that's what priests do as well. So that man kind of, while if he's implying that I'm not doing my work properly, I think he better get a life for himself. He better come up towards Castle and ask any of the people.
I'm implying no such thing, but I think you're carried away at this stage by your own hubris.
I'm not carried away at all, sir. Absolutely not carried away. That's your opinion.
It's time for a little humility. Joe, that's all I really want to say, and I wish you all good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Michael.
And it didn't end there. You're a Star singer, James Kilbane, also rang in. He objects to the inclusion of Daniel O'Donnell on the bill for the Pope's concert because he said Daniel advocated a yes vote in the same-sex marriage referendum. James himself voted no. Well, Malcolm was listening in Waterford. He's a gay man and a Christian, and he was very hurt by James Kilbane's argument.
If everybody, you respect, everybody is entitled to their civil respect. Everybody is entitled to that.
But that's all I'm asking from you, James.
I'm not angry.
But you're saying that Daniel O'Donnell should be removed from the bill in the Croke Park.
No, I think
you
called.
You said Daniel O'Donnell was unchristian. That's not being civil.
I did not say he was unchristian.
And you did.
I have it wrote down in front of me.
He said he took an anti-Christian position.
Yeah, well, that's the same thing, James.
Come on. That's an anti-Catholic position. It's not an anti-Christian.
Are you a theologian?
Are you?
No.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Monday. Well, over on the Today Show with Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday, the focus was on love, heartbreak and loss as Brian O'Connell trawled through the classified ads online. On Dundeel, he spotted an engagement and wedding ring for sale for €3,000 and he went in search of the story behind the ad.
I married a non-EU national in Beirut in Lebanon in December 2015.
Mm-hmm.
We had known each other a year and a half at that stage.
Had you any hesitations? Did you think, oh, this is all a bit quick?
In my naivety, no. I had considered briefly motivations as to why you would ask somebody so quickly, but I would have thought maybe he loved me. I didn't really question that.
Mm-hmm.
I should have. I returned back from Beirut after getting married in December, and after Christmas, I set out on applying for his visa to come to Ireland. It's a spousal visa.
So you went through the process of applying for a visa. Costly enough process too, I'd imagine.
€4,000 is what it cost.
Were you successful?
Nope. His visa was refused in August of 2017. The day after I telling him that it was refused, he went and married somebody else.
Not the first woman in the world to be duped by a cad.
For a while, I was kind of bargaining with him. It's okay. You can remain married to her and you can remain married to me as well. He can have 4 wives after all.
So that was, what, 11 months ago, 10 or 11 months ago?
Yeah. So I have moved on significantly since then. I mean, I look back now and my bargaining with him to, you know, we can both have you. Such was my desperation to keep him.
But it's the last thing you expect. You've told everybody you've been part of this amazing day.
It was an enormous shock. I couldn't even talk about it, to be honest. Mm. There was a lot of shame.
Why shame?
Because I should have known better. You read these things, you see these things on shows, and you're saying to yourself, that would never happen to me. But it happens.
With the wedding rings, can I ask, where did you buy them and how much did they cost roughly?
I got them in Dubai. In total, they were 5,000 euros.
Mm-hmm. You paid the majority of that?
I paid the majority of that. Yeah, he would have paid very, very little of that. When they were on me, everyone would stop and they would pick them up, and the weight of them, they would say, these are beautiful, beautiful rings. I think it can happen to anyone. And I think you can't beat yourself up about it.
Well, look, I hope you get a buyer for the rings. Mm-hmm. They're getting something for less than half price, probably.
Mm-hmm.
For now, they're kept safe in this box.
Absolutely.
Do you ever put them on?
No, not anymore. They're not mine anymore. I hope they go on someone's finger that will have many years of happy marriage.
Well, isn't she well rid of them? Brian O'Connell reporting for Today with Miriam O'Callaghan. The acclaimed actress Fionnuala Flanagan's work has taken her all over the world, but even after 50 years, she still calls Ireland home. This time, she was back home from Los Angeles for a premiere at the Galway Film Fla, meeting with old friends and old enemies. She and her dog, Betty, joined Dave Fanning in studio on Thursday, and she's such a fantastic storyteller with tales of her father fighting against General Franco in Spain, the inside track on Hollywood's royalty, her admiration for President Michael D. Higgins, and her love for her late husband, the distinguished psychiatrist Garrett O'Connor.
Well, people will associate Fionnuala Flanagan with 40 years of brilliant acting and Hollywood and big screen and all the rest, and I haven't even started on that yet, which I will, but you entered the Baltimore Hotel and you met the love of your life.
But it wasn't even a hotel, it was a motel.
That's right.
Because I was on tour with Brian Friel's Lovers. That's what took me to Broadway and then on tour. Eamon Morrissey played opposite me in that. And I hear this raucous laughter outside my motel room, and I open the door, and there's Eamon leaning up against the wall, laughing his head off, and there, kneeling on the floor, telling a funny story, was Garrett O'Connor, whom I subsequently married. And
Gareth was married at the time. And
yes.
Like, it was a ships in the night thing it was going to be for you. Like, what a wonderful man to meet, but that's it.
Yes, that's really what it was. But it was much more than that for him. Yeah. Well, people have asked us, you know, was it love at first sight? And Gareth always said yes immediately. And then they turned to me and I would say, well, it took me maybe 3 or 4 days.
You know, you fancied him and he fancied you, and he was the one who had to pursue it because he had a different life and so on. But like, I mean, after a bunch of years and sort of crazy carry on or whatever, the man became very famous, didn't he? You were there for like, you know, this business of being a really kind of one of the most important, I don't know, nails in the wonderful place that is the Betty Ford Clinic.
Yes, he was someone who, first of all, he drank very heavily and when I met him, and 6 years later, because he had a choice to make, either it was going to kill him or he would get sober, and he got sober. And he stayed sober for the rest of his life. And then he also decided at that time that he wanted to devote his life to helping other people get sober and helping families who were suffering from addiction or alcoholism. And that's what he did. So he had a private practice in Los Angeles, and the Betty Ford Clinic asked him to become the chief psychiatrist.
Fionnuala Flanagan with Dave Fanning on Thursday. Another fine actress and singer, Honor Heffernan, was featured on Pantysocracy on Tuesday night, along with her partner, the composer and musician Trevor Knight.
The record is songs that were all, the lyrics are from Dorothy Parker's work, and you put them to music.
Yeah.
And there's an album, and it's called The Whistling Girl.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Well, there's an old saying, a whistling girl and a crowing hen are no use to God or man, because girls who whistled were bold girls.
Oh.
One of her poems was called The Whistling Girl. Mm. So Trevor put music to that.
So the first thing you're going to do is called Symptom Recital. And do you want to tell us anything about it before you do it? Or?
I know, I think it speaks for itself.
I do not like my state of mind. I'm bitter, querulous, unkind. I hate my legs, I hate my hands. I do not yearn for lovelier lands. I do not like my state of mind. I'm bitter, querulous, unkind. I hate my legs, I hate my hands. I do not yearn for lovely lands. I dread the dawn's recurrent light. I hate to go to bed at night. I sneer at simple earnest folk. I cannot take the gentlest joke. I find no peace in paint or type. My world is but a lot of tripe. I'm disillusioned, empty-breasted. For what I think I'd be arrested.
Honor Heffernan and Trevor Knight heard on Pantysocracy with Panty Bliss, a.k.a. Rory O'Neill. The comedian and writer Aisling Bee was the featured guest on Second Captains last Saturday morning, and she was well up for it when she spoke with Owen McDevitt.
People know he was a comedian.
But not as a sports star.
But not as a sports superstar. This is what this next half an hour is all about.
Me, finally launching my sporting career.
Horses is your background.
Horses is my background.
That's not really a question.
Sounded like an accusation. Yes, so I grew up in just outside of Kildare town to an equine vet of a father. And my mother is a retired professional flat race jockey.
Right. So tell us about your mother's career then, as best you know. How did she end up becoming a flat race jockey?
Well, she comes from a very horsey background. She was quite a pioneer for female jockeys. Herself and Joanna Morgan were kind of coming up around the same time. Joanna's still a trainer now. And my mother has worked in horse racing all her life. Like, it's weird because it's kind of like imagine if you were brought up in a town full of magicians and both of your parents were magicians. The town's industry was fueled by magicians. And suddenly you went to Dublin one day and people were like, magicians? You're like, I know, it's so boring. Because in Kildare, like, loads of people's parents were either jockeys or in the army or worked for farriers or had something to do with even horses in the army. And so it just felt really normal that everyone had something to do with the horse racing industry in Kildare. My summer job was working on the stud farm and the Irish National Stud as a tour guide. And even still, people are like, oh, you should write more stand-up about that. I'm like, but what angle? Isn't everybody's mother a jockey?
Aisling's father took his own life when she was only 3, and when she wrote about her heartache in the Guardian newspaper, the reaction was overwhelming. She says she's since read every single letter, every text, every email that thousands of her fans had sent to her.
A big part of the point of me writing it was to start a conversation, to have a place. If you want to, this random person off the telly who you see on random panel shows, if you want to just throw a message with all of your feelings at me, I might not reply, but bloody do it. Send it, get it off your chest, send it to a stranger, write yourself a letter or an email of hopefulness and what you want to achieve or all the bad things and hope no one will write. Like, do it. And there's also something very therapeutic about writing. And why I was quite honoured to get a lot of these messages is when you write something, when you write a story, you can give it a beginning, middle and end. Whereas when you just constantly talk about stuff, like kind of now, it comes out in scattered thoughts and bits from then and bits from the future and bits from the past. But when you write something down, you have to give your brain a chance to give it a shape and a structure. And I think there's something lovely about that.
What about for you, Aisling? You said in that Adam Buxton interview that you feel like a different person since the article came out.
Completely and utterly. Yeah, really? Totally. Just, I think it felt a little bit like we sort of had the funeral in a sense. It was an odd thing, that sort of release of something, which you didn't know you'd been holding on to for so long. And I think it's the same with a lot of people when they start opening up or talking about something. I think I always thought that the world was going to kind of collapse, and it didn't, and you'll be grand. And I think that's what I realised talking about it, because people are always like, oh, I was just afraid you'd get upset. I was just afraid I'd upset you, or I was just so afraid we'd upset your mother. I was so afraid we'd upset you. We didn't want to make anyone upset. And if you don't get upset, there's no way you can get over anything. To think you can kind of keep pushing through without ever getting upset is ridiculous. And it took me 30 years. But honestly, I just feel freer. I feel so free, and that there's never going to be a shock thing now that's going to come around the corner. Like, so you were talking about your father and how your father, like, it felt like it was going to creep up on me whenever I was doing like Jonathan Ross or something like that. Like, I'd get a curveball question. Whereas now, like, at worst, you're just going to upset someone. But it'll be out there. Then it's past and it's gone. And it is like little tumours being removed from your soul a little bit. So I would highly advise everyone to write an article for The Guardian if you get a chance, you know.
Comedian Aisling Bee heard on Second Captains last Saturday morning. In her day job, Emily Pine is an academic. She lectures in drama at UCD and has published widely on Irish culture. But her new book, Notes to Self, published by Tramp Press, is very personal. 6 essays on subjects like addiction, fertility, depression, rape. Emily Pine was Sean Rock's guest on Tuesday night's Arena.
When we first started talking about the collection, I had only written one essay, which is the essay about my father's alcoholism. And then when I said, they asked, could I develop it into something else? And they said, what else would you like to write about? And I said, I don't know. What would you like me to write about? And we came up with this series of questions where we said, well, what would you say if you weren't afraid to say it? And what do you really want to say? And so I started writing.
Were there many internal conversations, many moments of doubt, many questions that you asked yourself about writing about the subjects that you're writing about?
Yes, there are. And I mean, I actually pose the debate in some of the essays themselves in the book. You know, I talk about how difficult it is to expose some of the things I've kept secret or private, or in fact, haven't wanted to face myself, let alone, you know, wanted to show them to other people because you feel embarrassed or you feel scared or you feel that you failed somehow. And I thought it was really important to be as honest as possible and to face those things. And people have said to me since it's been published, oh, you're so brave. And I joke, I say, you know, if I had thought I was being brave, I probably wouldn't have done it. I just wanted to have that out on the page. And I talk about how you can make yourself vulnerable, but also feel powerful in doing that. You claim a power over your own story in telling it.
I need to ask you about the second last essay in the book, which is Something About Me, where you detail 2 rapes. You were raped twice in your teens. Telling those stories can't have been easy at all. You tell them very directly, very straight. But you put that essay second last. You said you wanted people to get to know you first.
Mm.
When did you write it? And why did you not think, hit them between the eyes, step up, number one, here I am, this is me?
Because this is my story, Sean, you know? And when I say I want people to know me, that essay has a lot about me drinking and not going to school and breaking all sorts of rules. And I felt at the time, and again, I try to talk about this in the essay. The essay isn't just about the, you know, here is a chronology of events, but this is how I feel about now about that chronology of events. And I had put those experiences in a box and I had closed the lid on the box and I had actually done so very successfully. To open that lid and to write about it was incredibly painful, was really difficult. And, you know, to share it with other people, I had never told anybody. I mean, except in very kind of loose terms, but I had never told anybody the actual mechanism of what had happened to me with those 2 men in 2 different occasions. The first time I was 15, the second time I was 17. And they had real lasting effects on me, but I wouldn't admit the effect. So again, the book is about taking a step back and looking at various incidents and talking about what they mean. And it's not just me. You know, this is the reason for writing it.
Emily Pine with Sean Rocks on Tuesday. It's just over 2 years since Helen Dillon sold her big house and famous garden in Ranelagh and swapped it for a bungalow and coastal garden on Dublin's south side, a major adventure after 45 years.
You don't like the word downsizing?
No. It makes me think of sitting by the fire, stuck next to the fire and not going outside and getting older and older and then falling to bits, bang, like that. Crash on the floor. The very exciting thing is a new garden at my age, when I've been sort of 45 years in the last garden, is a wonderful, completely empty sheet of paper to paint on.
Great way to look at it. And how many of your plants did you bring and how
tons
did
of
you...
them. Tons,
tons
of them.
Tons of them.
Tons of them. Because I'd had 9 months to pop things up, you see.
You took cuttings.
Cuttings and small bits, because I don't believe in completely robbing a garden before you go, particularly as the people who bought the house were nice people and didn't mess us about. It wouldn't be fair. And some people stripped the place, but I didn't want to strip the place. I just wanted a little bit.
And what kinds of plants did you decide to bring with
you?
Well,
all the ones that I couldn't get easily again. If the thing was very easy to get again, there wasn't much point in digging it up, unless it was always very expensive, which most of them aren't. Just everything I really liked. And the wonderful thing was to leave plants behind that I didn't particularly like. I used to give a talk called Dig It Up and Throw It Away, because I was always trying to encourage people to have the guts to throw something away, because that is what blocks up the garden, is all those things that shouldn't really be there because you don't particularly like them and you don't actually see them because you're so busy rushing to look at the thing you do like that you haven't noticed that this very boring old plant is stuck in the corner. Since I've moved, I've managed to really, really enjoy gardening.
Celebrity gardener Helen Dillon heard on the Marion Finucane show last Saturday. Well, Joe Duffy made his debut on Sunday Miscellany this week with a script about growing up in Dublin's Ballyfermot. He remembered how his mother always insisted they must never be seen buying margarine, no matter how tight funds were, but didn't seem to have any embarrassment about sending Joe and his brother Peter off with fuel vouchers to the turf depot, 3 miles away, when they were low on fuel. The two boys made the trip pushing their baby brother Aidan's pram to transport the turf, feeling self-conscious all the way.
Peter and I would take turns gripping and pushing the white rubber-clad handle of the pram. The effort rendered us almost horizontal, while the other would push from the side and stop it from rolling back down the hill. But neither of us could let up or let go. We skulked hurriedly past our school. We beat a steady path, shifting from the shadows only once when Gobi the Wall, the local walking book reader, headed straight in our direction and refused to deviate, as always. And we dared not give up. We'd always done what Mother told us since the day she caught myself and Peter mitching from school. Well, actually, we gave ourselves up after 2 hours of boredom. Our stuttering excuse that the school was closed, expiring within seconds, as Mother's instinct reduced us to a pair of blubbering truth-tellers, and she propelled us upstairs with the help of the wooden spoon. We did our best, gathering extra wind as we got to the main row of shops, not because of the nasty incline, but because it was here we were most likely to be spotted by passing neighbours on the top deck of the 78 bus.
Writer, painter, historian, broadcaster Joe Duffy heard on Sunday Miscellany. Professor Donal O'Shea is the clinical lead for obesity in the HSE, and not for the first time he shocked us with the stats on our childhood obesity epidemic. Professor O'Shea has now turned his gaze on product placement targeting children, the hidden persuaders.
So you mentioned Cadbury's and Tato, and this is the sponsorship of big corporations of activities.
Yeah, I mean, you go onto their corporate websites and they'll say, we no longer promote in any way, shape or form to under 12-year-olds. And Coca-Cola do that while putting babies' names on bottles. Cadbury's do it while sponsoring a kind of a health camp. And it's to promote activity for families in a family-friendly environment, a bit like Tato Park. But it is well established by all psychologists that sponsorship is advertising. And it's just a very good way of getting their product visible in a positive way repeatedly to 12-year-olds. So it's repeated imaging. So if you watched any of the World Cup, you'll have seen McDelivery in the background constantly through the game.
So the Cadbury's thing, is that sponsorship? Because the Tato Park model is different in that the man who used to own Tato sort of set it up. It was a bit of a labour of love.
Yeah, and I've been to Tato Park. It's a great day out. It's a really good family day out. But you have crisps coming out your ears, and all the rides there are designed with the Tato colouring. So you've got this subliminal promotion of their product. And that's what they have to do. They're very good at it. But we have to get people to realise. So people say, oh, it's the parents' fault and that children are getting fat. In fact, it's the food and drinks industry being magnificent at what they do. We think we're making an independent choice when we go out to buy something, but it's influenced. The micro-advertising, the online advertising, targeting our youngest is magnificent. And in fairness, the message is getting through to the better off, better educated sections of our population. So childhood obesity in South County Dublin in the well-off areas is on the way down. But if you go to the less well-off, poorest areas, it's continuing to climb.
Why is that, do you think?
That's because you have to be disciplined and educated and very well informed to be better than the environment. And the easy option in the less well-off areas is the cheaper, high-fat, high-salt, high-sugar, peddled repeatedly.
Mm. Professor Donal O'Shea with Ray Darcy on Thursday. This week's documentary on One followed a group of retired women from Wexford on a golden years holiday to Westport in County Mayo, When they got to the hotel, they discovered that the music the band played was more country and Irish than country and Western, and they wanted country and Western so they could line dance. Anyway, by the second night, the hotel had their kind of music sorted, and they were happy out.
Outside in the smoking area, though, two of the ladies are not happy with the dancing. It's not the music, it's one of their friends, who they think made a show of herself.
She was molesting every man that got up on the floor.
But did she not have good dance moves?
Not really, no.
No?
They were yoga moves.
Yoga moves?
They were like yoga moves.
Yeah. And were the men liking her dancing?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, I'll take it she was having a good time anyway.
Oh, yeah, she was enjoying herself. Yeah. No, I do always admit it. I'm an exhibitionist when it comes to dancing. I can't just go out and jiggle from side to side like the other women, you know. I'm throwing myself around the place too. But not to that extent, no. No. And if I'm talking to her tomorrow, I'll say to her, you'll have to calm down.
And how do you think
the vice squad will be in looking for you.
And how do you think she'd react to that?
Oh, no, she wouldn't react. She'd hit me.
Good night, all.
Good night, now. See you tomorrow.
Thank you so much, folks. That's
much better than last night. Yeah.
River Chapel Ladies on Tour was narrated by Emer McBride and produced by Nathan Walsh and Ronan Kelly. And you can listen back to the full documentary from the usual podcast providers or from the Documentary on One mobile app. Morning Ireland reporter Cian McCormack was back on his bike this week, checking out the beauty of Ireland's hidden heartlands. On Monday, he cycled the Southern Trail Greenway, which runs 40 kilometres from Rathkeel to the Kerry border, via Abbeyfeel and Newcastle West. The Greenway was started 30 years ago by the local community, but now Limerick City and County Council has come on board.
My name is John McAuliffe. I'm from Tipperary Lantin. Well, the trail, it goes through my passageway into the house, and the trail goes through my passage. I got involved in the early days because, we didn't know what was going to happen, so we had to object, you know. We considered about robberies and about people, you know, undesirables on the line.
How are you feeling about this development now as a tourist product?
Great job. Yeah, very pleased. No problems.
And what changed your mind?
Well, there was a committee set up in Newcastle West that time, and they sat down with everyone sat down together, and they spoke and they ironed out things.
Patrick Reardon from Timothy Glenton, farming in Timothy Glenton. But I work on it for the rural social scheme with the last 12 years. There's at least six of us.
And what do you be doing?
We cut the grass and cut briars in the winter time.
So you're actually seeing the benefit from this, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, it is a great scheme for the likes of us, for small farmers. Just keeping us going.
Cian McCormack reporting from Ireland's hidden heartlands for Morning Ireland all week. The poet Yvan Boland was in reflective mood with Keelan Shanley last Sunday.
You've spoken of it often before that you pursued the personal in poetry.
Keelan, I married at 24. I'd been at Trinity College and I taught there, and that was in a way a sheltered world. And then I married and moved to this great place in Dundrum where we've lived since, and Kevin and I were great neighbours, who were friends of ours, and I saw them living the lives I wanted to live, that I admired for their generosity, making their children's lives better, making a neighbourhood. And I began to think, if I can't put the life I'm living here into the poem I'm writing, then there's not going to be any connection for me as a poet. And when I did that, then of course I began to meet the sort of challenges that this is just women's stuff, this is niche poetry, this is diluting the larger subjects. And I began to think, look, I better make some kind of critique for what I'm doing, or it'll be made for me. And that led me into some more kind of senses of argument about it.
And Night Feed, of course, is one of those poems, the personal poetry. Would you mind reading it for us?
Of course I will. And, you know, I dedicate poems, of course, but this is about my wonderful first daughter, Sarah, and I'll read it today for her. She now has a very small baby who I think...
She's living this.
I think she's living it with maybe a few more night feeds than she might like to do. Night feed. This is dawn. Believe me, this is your season, little daughter. The moment daisies open, the hour mercurial rainwater makes a mirror for sparrows. It's time we drowned our sorrows. I tiptoe in, I lift you up, wriggling in your rosy, zipped sleeper. Yes, this is the hour for the early bird and me, when finder is keeper. I crook the bottle, how you suckle. This is the best I can be. Housewife to this nursery, where you hold on, dear life. A silt of milk, the last suck, and now your eyes are open, birth-coloured and offended. Earth wakes, you go back to sleep. The feed is ended. Worms turn, stars go in. Even the moon is losing face. Poplars stilled for dawn, and we begin the long fall from grace. I tuck you in.
Yvonne Boland reading her much-loved poem, Night Feed. Well, over on Like Family, it was all about childbirth and newborn babies too. Brenda Donoghue was joined by her own mother, Mary, her auntie Nan, and her mam's best friend, Rita. And Mary recalled the day she went into hospital to give birth to Brenda.
I was dropped at the door. My mother kissed me goodbye, wished me luck. The husband, I looked around, he was missing, he was gone. But I have to say, the loneliness then... When you're on your own, and I mean, strange people all around her, and all of a sudden then, you start to, that evening then, that night, all the next day, up to 7 o'clock, I was in labour, and I can tell you now, if you had a video, which they hadn't in those days, it would have been good, because there was a woman beside me having her 11th child, and she said she laughed that much at me, that the child hopped out, she had no labour at all. And I was in the throes of it. Then, all of a sudden, anyway, Bren, after, oh, I suppose nearly 2 days, out to come. Yeah, the nurse, anyway, just put you straight in front of me. I saw this little face smiling. And it was like as if you had no bother at all coming into the world. As if you were just delighted with yourself, with a little smile on your face. And I said to myself, thank God for that, I said. And I lay back, and I didn't see you for nearly the day. But I heard children crying in the nursery that night. And I don't know, something made me get out of the bed. And I crept down to the nursery, and you were the one that was crying.
Would any of your husbands have considered for them to come into the labour ward? Oh,
definitely not, Brenda.
Oh, God, no.
Or anybody else would have gone?
No, under no circumstance. You know, when I think of it after, like, you wouldn't. Because, you know, well, it is a private thing as well.
I wouldn't have wanted him in at all either. Even with the twins, he was standing out. When I had my twin girls, he was standing out in the hall. And the nurse did say to him, do you want to go in? And he didn't want to come in himself.
Nan.
But I think, Brenda, if the husband came in, it'd turn him off for life. And there might be no more. And there might be no more brothers and sisters.
From Like Family with Brenda Donoghue last Wednesday night. But I leave you now with a song from Mary Coughlan with Jimmy Smith on guitar and harmonies. They played live on Sunday with Keelan. Gurmahag of Oswar Golluder, Tasulam Gurwanshev, Saltasaglar, August Kameshivlam, Tak Anamakiana, and Tachtan Chahagin, Gaji Shin, Gajeshab Slan.
I get out of bed and drag my makeup on. I walk out on the streets, my every exit covered. I hitch up my pants, I'll fake it just like a man.